You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner, Kent, the editor-in-chief, and I'm here with...
Deep Tran, associate editor.
Susie Evans. Sorry, I forgot my name for a second. Senior editor.
It happens. Today we'll talk about a little bit about that award show that happens every year. The nominations were out as today's taping.
Rob's favorite award show.
And then we'll talk about
the Tonys.
And then we'll talk about AIPAC, which is not the American Israeli Political Action Committee. But the Asian American, tell me.
The Asian American Performers Action Coalition.
Right.
They are based in New York City, and they're a group of New York City Asian American actors. And they have been doing this study about the demographic breakdown of actors on Broadway and off.
And in New York, yeah. Just based in New York theater. They do for all diversity, right? A multicultural study. They're the ones doing it. Yeah, it's very valuable. And they just released their...
14,
new study.
15.
We'll talk about that for the previous season. So we'll be talking about this past season on Broadway because it's the Tonys, and then about all of New York theater. And then we promised to talk about things other than New York as well. We have an interview with Erica Daniels, who is vice president at Second City.
She's president.
She's the president of Second City.
She's the president of Second City Theatricals.
She's number one at Second City.
She used to be the associate artistic director at Steppenwolf.
Right.
Under Martha Levy's leadership.
So we have a great interview with her, and then we'll come back at the end and do some recommendations and things to talk about. So let's start off with the Antoinette Perry nominations. What do we say about them? Were there any big surprises? We knew Hamilton was going to get a lot of nominations. Weren't sure it was going to be historic. I think it has the most nominations ever. 16.
Most nominations a show has ever received, 16 nominations.
Right. So I know there were some categories where some folks were canceled out of that.
What do you mean canceled out? Like there's multiple people in categories.
Right, exactly.
So they can't win all 16.
No, they can't win all 16. But there was none that canceled
why?
Out. Right?
Why? Why?
All the leads were nominated.
All 16 because there's three nominees in one acting category. There's two nominees in another acting category.
So it's going to be either Leslie Odom or David Diggs or Chris Jackson.
No, it's going to be Leslie Odom or Lynn. And it's going to be
the leads.
Yeah.
And it's going to be David, Chris Jackson, or Jonathan Groff.
Yeah. I mean, those divisions make some sense in terms of featured. Why is Reed Birney, just to switch to the humans, why is that considered a featured role? He's in the whole play.
Everyone's in the whole play.
Well, but no spoilers, but he's like the main character. I'm sorry. He's not a featured actor in that play.
Because you need to feel the burn, Rob, and you need Reed Birney to get a nomination.
Well,
be his next role on stage.
My thing is I don't follow this very closely. I have no idea. Who's he up against? Who would he be up against if he were in the lead actor? Gabriel Byrne?
He'd be up against like Mark Strong from View from the Bridge and Jeff Daniels from Blackbird. Mm. And
yeah, he competes well with all those. I think you should, you know. Anyway, that the categories are always kind of a strange thing.
Well, they always fight. I mean, Shuffle Along wanted to be a revival, and they made it a new musical.
It's clearly not a revival.
There's
two lines from the original production in it.
That was a big debate, though, wasn't it?
It was huge. I mean, the producers, for those of you who don't know, the producers campaigned to get these – actors and productions in different categories because I think they have better shots. And
the thing that is this a fairly new thing where the Tonys have basically they started to call things revivals that have never been on Broadway. That's become like a common thing.
Well, no, and they're not going to do that anymore. That happened with Hedwig and Violet. They called them revivals and they've never been on Broadway.
With Blackbird.
And did they call it? They called
it
a revival.
A revival, even though it's never been on Broadway.
Is it in the revival category?
Yep, it is in the revival category.
Really?
I feel like they just come with the politics of that are like that's a 2005, 2006 play from England, and it came to here in 2007 and ran off Broadway. So I guess if it's old enough, it's considered a revival. But why wouldn't Eclipse be a revival? I guess because it never played in New York before. Eclipse has been around for like 6 years.
Yeah, that makes no sense. Did you fact check that, Deep?
I did not fact check it.
I did because I was looking through the.
It's really nominated for Best Revival of Play?
Mm-hmm.
That's weird that Eclipse
play.
Isn't. You know, it might be just a producer campaigning for...
Well, I think someone might argue it's been in New York though. Before, right?
Well, or Scott Rudin could argue that The Humans is a best play and he wants his other play, Blackbird, to be in revival.
Unless because The Eclipse came on from off to on Broadway in the same season, so I guess if it came to New York.
But the production that is Blackbird is almost exactly the Manhattan Theater Club production. It was just several years ago.
Yeah. This is where things get strange. And I've wondered about that. The revivals, I think, is actually a good. The revival musical category is a very competitive one, I guess. If I'm going to get into the horse
race. The new musical isn't competitive because Hamilton's in it.
Right, it's not competitive at all.
Should we say what the revivals are? They're
Fiddler on the Roof,
The Color Purple,
Bach and Harnack competing with themselves.
Yeah, The Color Purple and Spring Awakening.
And it's interesting. You've got two sort of Golden Age shows. And then two very recent shows, like, you know, shows that people wonder why do we need a revival already of Spring Awakening and Color Purple. They're both tremendous revivals. I would give Color Purple the edge. Is that all? There's not enough?
There's four. There's only four.
There's four.
Yeah. I would give Color Purple the edge too, but all four of them are great.
They are.
I mean, She Loves Me of the revivals has the most nominations total.
Right.
Of revivals being nominated. Hamilton obviously has the most nominations.
And Fiddler has a sort of prestige thing about it. I think everyone thought it was going to be a shoo-in after King and I last year, but it didn't get unanimous raves. And
I think it's a little bit different for Bart Scheer what he's doing with Fiddler this production. It's not his standard lush Lincoln Center extravaganza, which is
I just think the Snap has gone out of its direction overall, including last year too. But that's me. I talked to someone about it who shall remain nameless. It basically feels like he's done too many operas and sort of has this distance from his material. But that maybe isn't fair.
Oh, I like him. I just think this felt different.
South Pacific was great, and that was the last great thing.
And Danny and him worked together on South Pacific.
And Danny is a great actor.
Danny's fantastic. Danny's the Kelly O'Hara of this year. It's his sixth nomination.
This is Danny Burstein. We're talking as if everyone knows who we're talking about. Danny Burstein, who's playing Tevye. And giving a very understated and moving performance as him in this revival. The other big snub that people talk about is Audra didn't get it.
Did you see her tweet?
Who's won like 15 Tonys already. What?
Somebody tweeted, is anyone shocked that Audra didn't get nominated? And Audra retweeted it and goes, Audra isn't. And Audra is thrilled with the nominations. She's a class act.
Well, I'll talk about
She doesn't need any more Tonys.
She's already won the most.
I feel like I was really happy to see Adrian Warren get us a featured actor. But that and Brandon too. Brandon Victor Dixon, that is. These are two of the supporting actors in
Shuffle Along.
Featured actor in Shuffle Along. But that ensemble is the star.
Well, Savion choreography.
Yeah, but I mean, I feel like the biggest applause is for their executions of his photography. And you know,
choreography.
Did I say that?
You said photography.
His photography is amazing.
Wrong award show, Rob.
His photography is amazing, Savion.
At the end of the day here, guys.
The stars all hold their own, but it's really an ensemble show.
Diversity, because...
Is there anything... Yeah, diversity, what about that? What do you want to say about that?
Because I remember before the Tony nominations came out, Michael Paulson wrote an article in the Times about what the diversity on stage this year on Broadway means for the Tony nominations. And has that question been answered? Is it because I believe I read an article that said 14 out of the 40 people nominated in the acting categories.
It was
are
a tweet, but yes, 14
color.
Out of 40, yeah.
And, but then there's only one person of color nominated on the design team and director creative wise, I think is it, I didn't.
So George Wolfe.
Liesl Tommy
and Danai Gurira for Eclipse.
Right, right.
Is that it? Yeah.
Right.
So you know Tony history, Susie.
Oh my gosh, not that well.
Well, Tony history is, I mean, you know.
Like, relatively, is it the most diverse nominating group ever assembled?
I feel like the year Fences was on Broadway and Viola Davis and Denzel Washington won. And
Sophie.
Sophie. But that was not, there weren't a lot of nominees from Raisin in the Sun that year, so I don't know if that was a big nominees. I feel like, I could be completely wrong here, but I feel like the year Fences was on Broadway was pretty diverse. Maybe not as diverse as this is, though.
This is a very diverse season on stage. It is very true. I mean, I can remember when Julie Taymor and Gary Hines won directing awards for Beauty Queen of Linane and Lion King, respectively, or vice opposite, respectively. They were the first women to ever win Tonys for direction, ever. So I think that the Broadway's been extremely not diverse at the top of, in terms of writers and directors. I mean,
wasn't Yasmin Riza the first? Not the first. She wasn't the first woman to win Best Play.
I would not be. Well,
did Lorraine Hansberry win it?
Did she win Lorraine Hansberry?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Were there Tonys?
Let's fact check.
We're
gonna. I'm pretty sure something happened when Yasmin Riza won for God of Carnage. Mm-hmm. It was some sort of historical thing. We're fact checking, guys.
All right. So yeah, I mean, we were considering whether wasn't it something about how Liesl Tommy and Danai Gurira were the first
all
play in which it was
all black.
What? But, no. Eclipse is the first play with an all female cast and production team. Full stop. Creative team. And Waitress is the first musical with an all-female creative team, full stop, on Broadway.
Oh, but yeah.
Even
but
designers,
that's
too?
That's been challenged. Yeah.
Well, not designers. They think director, choreographer, producer.
Lyricist, producer.
Yeah.
Songwriter.
Yeah.
All right. The first musical.
First musical. And Eclipse
true,
is the
true
first.
That when I look back at Broadway productions written by women, we were hard-pressed to find productions written by women that were also directed by women. I didn't do an exhaustive search of IBDB, the database, but I encourage our readers, if you want to correct us if we're wrong, was Marsha Norman or Wendy Wasserstein ever directed by a woman when they were on Broadway? I don't know.
Well, Wendy Wasserstein, the revival of Heidi Chronicles, was directed by Pam McKinnon.
Aha. Well, there you go.
Oh, just fact-checked it.
Yeah.
Lorraine Hansberry didn't actually win Best Play for Raisin in the Sun, so she never got a Tony for that.
Wow. But she probably never got a Tony then.
Yeah.
Because that was her big play.
Yep. She was only nominated.
I want to find. I think it might have been Yasmina, which is like 2008.
Yeah. No, these were striking things, and the fact that there was directors so late as well.
There wasn't female directors before 1990.
Well, I mean that there were directors winning Tonys.
That's true.
I would not be. There weren't any female directors. Period. On the stage. You know, one thing about Broadway that's not exculpatory, that doesn't get them totally off the hook. You know, and this is one of my problems with the Tonys and with Broadway in general, is it's such a small pool. How many theaters are we talking about? It's a small number of shows. A small pool. Mm-hmm. Hollywood seems to do better on some of those metrics because there's just more chances for people to get to direct movies of all different sizes. If you looked at the entire theater scene, you would have a much better picture because, as we've reported, it's not perfect, but there are a lot more women and people of color working in the theater. If you look across the board, Broadway is this tiny aperture through which only the biggest shows that are going to sell lots of tickets go through. So
wait, I lied. Let's go back to fact checking. The first female author to win Best Play was Frances Goodrich with her partner with her husband for The Diary of Anne Frank.
Okay.
So
the first
she's
only
shared it.
Sole credit winning the Tony was Yasmina Riza?
I think it was.
All right.
But
the first woman to solely win Best Score was Cyndi Lauper. Like, these are the times, guys. These are like 2011 and like.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's
the first team to win Score was Fun Home last year.
Right, I know. That's, again, the creative talent on Broadway, we're talking producers, directors, and writers, has been overwhelmingly white men until very recently.
Unfortunately. But
I mean, and that's Broadway. Again, yeah. This is the small aperture through which
So then should
go.
We do a similar analysis for like the Lucille Lortels which honors Broadway and off?
Lucille Lortels is just off Broadway.
Okay.
Dramadesque is both.
Okay. There are literally five different award shows in New York.
Lortels are comparable in that they're, you know, given by
Outer Critics organization. Are both too.
And then there's the critics ones.
Isn't there one that recognizes Broadway, off Broadway and off and one?
I'm thinking it might be Outer Critics.
Yeah.
I don't know though.
Well, that's about as much awards talk as I can say.
I mean, I think we should give a shout out to Rob's piece online today about all the nonprofit backgrounds of the Tony nominees. We've done this the second year doing this piece. It always gets a lot of traction. Almost all of the performers and all the shows, I think there were like two exceptions, started a nonprofit, whether it was in England or in the States. Almost all the shows, I think Fiddler and There was one other.
Shuffle Along.
Shuffle Along are the only two shows that didn't have some sort
of. School of Rock.
And School of Rock.
Well, Blackbird. Oh, are we talking musicals?
Blackbird was at MTC.
And,
oh, Blackbird was at MTC, yeah.
Really? Interesting.
So,
I mean, you could argue it was a commercial production. It's just based on one that was at nonprofit before. I mean, and none of these artists. I mean, George Wolfe's Shuffle Along is direct to Broadway with no out-of-town tryout, but he's a, you know, he ran the public for 10 years. The guy's a nonprofit baby as much as a Broadway baby. So,
though my question is, if you take out the people, the nonprofits that own Broadway houses, then how many non-for-profit connections do you have left?
A lot. Old Globe, lot. Kennedy Center, Alliance.
American Repertory Theater. And Eclipse comes from all kinds of
public.
The public, you know, again.
Oh, the public.
Last year,
they don't own a house.
Last year was Fun Home. And now this year, Eclipsed and Hamilton were both on Broadway. Yeah, I mean, Roundabout did have a pretty good record. They had 3 shows nominated, all revivals, which is what Roundabout does, basically.
I think Roundabout got 27 nominations total. But that wasn't the Roundabout's production.
It's not the Roundabout's
production. It is actually the Roundabout's production.
It kind of is their production. It's not in one of their houses.
Well, it transferred from their off-Broadway space to the Broadway space.
But Scott Rudin transferred it. They didn't transfer themselves.
One of their Broadway spaces. Yeah. It's very complicated. They've got so many Broadway shows already running. They didn't have room in one of their Broadway houses for the transfer of their off-Broadway
show. And they also
don't
do new plays on Broadway. That's not in their mission. They do revivals on Broadway.
I think that's what
That's very
Todd
granular.
Said,
too. Why?
That's their mission. Why? I don't know. Ask Todd Haynes.
Did you ask Todd Haynes about that, Rob? It seems very granular and unnecessary, really.
Why?
If you have a great play like The Humans, like, wouldn't you want to be the one to transfer it rather than
I'm
having
sure they're
an
getting a cut. I'm sure they have
producer
some sort
come
of a
in?
Partnership.
Yeah, because they do so many really good new plays, especially in the Black Box. And
right, but they don't need to produce it on Broadway. Someone else
But
will
they
produce
transfer
it.
Them the same way the public does. The public doesn't have a house on Broadway that gets transferred by a commercial producer. So
yeah,
that's what Roundabout does with their new plays.
Yeah, but Roundabout already has houses. And so wouldn't it be easier to
But Roundabout is a
showcase?
Subscription season. And so nothing can really run as an open
all
run.
Their stuff.
And so everything's slotted into a subscription
right.
schedule.
And
that's
they just,
true,
they
too.
Do revivals. Although, you know, Thérèse Raquin, was that a revival?
That's a good question.
That's not really.
It actually was kind of a new play.
It's a new version of a classic.
Of a classic. So
yeah, I'm sure. You know, the funny thing is that the Todd Haynes piece that I did with him, their mission has expanded over the years. Mm-hmm. They didn't used to do new plays at all.
Yeah, and
they
that's what
the
Pels
They didn't used to do revivals of recent plays. They used to be old, like really old plays only. So then they do revivals by living writers, and you know they've expanded. So who knows? Maybe one day, Deep, your dream will come true. And Roundabout will be doing new plays on Broadway. And then, so just to give a shout out, the other two nonprofits that run theaters on Broadway, Lincoln Center, which doesn't have any real nominees this year, and Manhattan Theater Club, which has The Father, which is one.
I liked The Father a lot. Did you see it?
I did not see it.
Oh, I enjoyed it.
It sounded really depressing.
It is, but it was good. I was actually very entertained. I was surprised.
No, Frank Langella is great. And we have a wonderful piece. This is a chance to shout out by Misha Burson talking about if anyone's a big fan of Frank Langella from his film and TV work, as well as Ben Whishaw for his TV and film work.
Oh, that's a snub. Ben Whishaw should have been nominated.
She was great. She talks about their performances on stage in The Crucible and The Father, again, reverse respectively, Frank Langella and The Father and Ben Whishaw.
People are really
going
to be able to understand what we're talking about right now.
So
we sound like we're getting drinks at a bar.
Yes, I know. We need a drink here to make this.
We have wine in the kitchen, guys.
Let's move to the other topic. This week there was a forum called Beyond Orientalism, co-presented by CCG and the Asian American
Performers Action Coalition, the Alliance for Inclusion in the Arts, Fordham University, and I'm sure I'm missing one more sponsor in there, but there was a lot.
And it was talking a lot about Orientalism in the arts, from things like the Mikado on stage to such larger things outside the theater as the continuing whitewashing in film and TV. They also took the opportunity to unveil their study we mentioned before. They do a study which breaks out the different ethnic racial groups.
Exactly. Oh, they do basically a demographic breakdown of Broadway productions and 16 of the biggest non-for-profits in New York City.
And these are performance casting. This is actors.
Yes, this is for actors.
Okay. And what did they find? This is for the 14-15 season, the season before this amazingly diverse one we just talked about. But what did it look like?
In 14-15, the casting for people of color was at a 9-year high, with 30% of all available roles going to actors of color, a jump from 24% in the previous year, and exceeding the 9-year average of 23%.
So,
you know, 6 percentage points is a lot, guys. Not really. I'm being sarcastic. Let's see. African-American actors were cast in 17% of the roles, Latino actors 3%, Asian-American actors 9%, and all other people of color, including disabled actors, was less than 1%. Okay. And Caucasian actors fulfilled 70%. Off-Broadway was actually better than on-Broadway.
That's not surprising.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Read the complete study on their website.
Dive into those numbers. I mean, it's interesting. The national demographics are 38 to 62 people of color versus white folks. That's right now. In about 10, 20 years, it's not going to be that. And that, of course, as we've talked about before, that's not anywhere near what the New York demographics are. New York demographics are more like 77 people of color versus white folks. Obviously, New York theater doesn't reflect New York's demographics. It's getting closer to what the national demographics are, at least on overall. And that's a good sign.
It's encouraging.
Well, the most interesting thing about the study was the fact that these numbers of actors of color on stage, they're actually not from producers non-traditionally casting shows or casting actors in roles that are not racially specific. It's from usually like all ethnic, like shows like The King and I. What were the other things last season?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. I mean, pun bad.
I mean, are you including Hamilton in the public?
Yes.
Yeah, because that would be included in the overall New York numbers. Pun Bandu made that point that the non-traditional casting, that Asian Americans seem to be
all ethnicities, actually.
But he was saying, though, that the numbers had gone down for non-traditional casting for Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, I think, was his point, and that they tended to be less seen cast in roles where the race was not a factor, whatever you call that, non-traditional or colorblind or color conscious, whatever the term you use, like being cast in Shakespeare, being cast just as the what might be a white part, but just happens to be Asian.
Yeah, or non-racially specific part.
Non-racially specific. And that has the opportunities in that area have gone down, and that most of that employment reflects Here Lies Love, King and I, ethnically specific shows. I mean, what's interesting is I think, this is like August Wilson point would be, non-traditional casting, whatever. He was against it, but mainly because he felt like the resources going to that should be going to new plays by artists of color, written by them, directed by them. And I think basically we need to see progress on all those fronts, both your ethnically specific cast, the War Horses, cast with people, given opportunities to people of color, and then your August Wilsons and your King and I's and stuff, and then also new plays by people of color, and then of course the non-traditional casting. I mean, I think that they should all be happening. It shouldn't be a zero-sum thing.
Though the thing that I need to look more deeply into, because I didn't really get to read the whole study before we started recording, is what they defined as non-traditional casting. Because in some groups, non-traditional casting can just be non-racially specific roles. I think in the past they defined it as roles that were not racially specific and what actor filled those roles.
So it's not just revivals.
Yeah, it's not just revivals.
Clifford Odets with all Asians.
Yeah, it could be, like Hamilton could be included in that 10% number, but
as a non-traditionally cast show.
Yeah, but I need to look into that.
But how would you define Hamilton as non-traditionally cast?
It's roles that are not actually ethnically specific.
But they are in the breakdown of...
Exactly. Well, it's an unprecedented tradition of casting, which is just looking for ethnic actors, people of color, rather than specifically saying, which you would do in previous breakdowns, this character is white, this character is black, this character is Asian, or this character has no race. So, like, right. Lin-Manuel was very intentional in those breakdowns saying, this character has to be filled by an ethnic actor.
Well, as we talked about before, like with the question of Brightstar, the industry standards now become to specify as much as possible. Specify if it's going to be white, make that choice. Say it's white. If it's going to be not white, then you make that choice. If you really say it's does not specific, then you have to be really, you know, intentional about it and conscious of who you're bringing in and making sure it's a diverse cast.
But is that non-traditional? If you have a character in your play, and you're like, this character is not specified.
I don't know. I don't know. It depends how you define it, I guess.
Exactly. It depends on how you define it for a study like this. But then if you don't want to say non-traditional, then we say non-racially specific roles, which would be more
right.
particular.
I guess I would have to see an example of what you're talking
exactly,
about.
Exactly.
You know, exactly. To know.
Basically, the question is, where does Hamilton fit in within these breakdowns that we've just talked about?
Every conversation is about Hamilton.
Well, yeah.
Even when it's not about Hamilton.
I just don't think, I think it's much easier to talk about color conscious, non-traditional, whatever cast, whatever the term is, in terms of revivals of works that were previously seen as white only, or white dominated. We could talk all day about that. But we will now segue to Erica Daniels. You were in Chicago recently and you sat down with...
Yeah, I went and visited Chicago, I think, about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I had the opportunity to sit down with Erica Daniels, who I'd never met before. And she's fantastic. We had a really fun chat. She is the president of Second City Theatricals. She just joined, I think, exactly a year ago. She was at Steppenwolf for, I think, 15 years. She'd worked at some agencies in New York. She's worked as a casting director. We talked about people she'd cast who'd gone on to big careers. We talked about Second City's new kind of theatricals division. They're doing partnerships with some nonprofit theaters. They're commissioning playwrights. They have a really cool partnership with Slate Magazine, doing a sketch comedy show about the election, which you'll learn more about in American Theaters Pages
okay,
soon.
Cool.
But, yeah. And so we had a fun, lively chat in her office in Chicago. So I hope you enjoy.
Enjoy.
Hi, this is Susie Evans, and I'm here in Chicago at the Second City headquarters with Erica Daniels, the director of touring.
The president of Second City Theatricals is the
president of
title.
But you, yes. How long have you been here?
I've been here. It will be a year, April 27th.
Oh my gosh. Is the date particularly?
No, it's just that it's, I'm just one of those people that I'm really good with dates and names. So, and phone numbers, like things like that I've always just been good at. So it's, just, and it's funny that it's going to be a year shortly. It's also that, to be honest, I am in like that zone of, oh, on April 27th, I can roll over my 401k from my last job. So it's just, I just literally emailed everybody I needed to email to get the form.
So
that's why it's in my head.
And I mean, and speaking of your last job was at Steppenwolf Theater Company, mm-hmm. also here in Chicago, as the director of casting.
I started as the casting director and the director of their school. And then the last 4.5 years was the associate artistic director and still did the casting, but the job was, you know, sort of formed around my skills.
Yeah. And how long were you there?
15 years.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And did you want to be a casting director? Did you want to be, what was kind of your like?
You know what? When I started in the business, and that was like in 91, I really started on the path of agenting and casting.
Mm-hmm. In Chicago?
I was in Chicago for about 9 years. And then I ended up in like early 2000 in New York.
Okay.
I worked at William Morris and was there for a couple of years in their theater department with George Lane.
Yep.
And then in 2001, late 2001, came back to work at Steppenwolf. Like in May, I guess. And originally it was to work primarily in casting. And then over the course of my evolution there, became more and more interested in programming and producing and everything else that goes into that, marketing and budgets. And so when, you know, they underwent their transition, I thought, okay, maybe it's time to explore what is next for me.
Okay. So the kind of impulse for you to come here was when they kind of announced Anna D. Shapiro and David
Schmidt. Yeah, like, David Schmidt's replacing David Hawkinson.
Replacing David Hawkinson. That was about a year ago, yeah?
Yeah, well, it was... Well, initially it was going, the announcement was like October of 14, I guess. You know, I just took a real like self look in the mirror, you know, at myself and what was going to make me comfortable. And I think change is really hard for me. I own that, you know, I'm not great with it. And, first of all, I didn't want to be the person in the corner, upset with the change and not embracing it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want that to be like my legacy there. Mm-hmm. I wanted and adore Anna and wanted her to succeed and to be able to bring in the people she wanted to bring in and make the changes she wanted to make. And just didn't know how I would receive, you know, those changes. Mm-hmm. And so thought, okay, well, maybe it's just time to explore what's next and see what's out there. Mm-hmm. And it was just a moment where they were looking here and this felt like a radical change, based on the types of stuff we do and the people. And it really was, you know, I didn't want to just make a change to make a change. It wasn't like I was going to the Goodman or going to Chicago Shakespeare. That wasn't the point. I wanted to sort of just turn things upside down a little bit. And this seemed like a way to really learn something new, all these different skill sets, and really learn about a different type of institution and meet a lot of new people. There's very little crossover.
That's surprising to me. Between those two.
Yeah, there's really, I mean, I think if I had a career in casting, in like the TV film world, you know, those people meet all of these people because these people audition in this building. They're auditioning for the TV shows and the commercials, but they're not necessarily auditioning for Steppenwolf. Mm-hmm. And the producers here have been, this is a team of people who have been here a really long time, many of them. So I just never had met anyone but the casting director here, Beth Kligerman. She's the only person I had met over my years. And it really wasn't until Sheldon Patinkin's memorial service where I was planning it on behalf of Steppenwolf, and Kelly Leonard and Ann Libera were planning it on behalf of Second City. So we were on this committee together with Columbia College. And it was in that moment that I sort of got to know them. And I was like, oh, they're really fun.
Yeah.
I wonder if I should even think about Second City. I wonder if they would ever want somebody with any of my skills. And so I randomly just like asked Kelly if he would meet with me. Mm-hmm. It was a very organic situation.
Wow. So you're the president of Second City Theatricals.
So what is
your job here?
So I'm basically supervising and managing the entire producing team here. So that has been, and I wasn't hired to do that originally. I was hired to be the vice president of Theatricals. And then 2 months after I arrived, Kelly decided to transition out of his full-time job. And it was not pre-planned. I did not come over knowing that was going to happen. But in July, Kelly decided, I came over April, and in early July, Kelly decided that he really wanted to do some different things and be a little bit more independent. And so while he's still an artistic consultant here, he's really not here full time. So I transitioned into managing the team here, which includes our resident stages. I work with the woman who produces the resident stages, which really are the primary things people know us for, the main stage in the ETC. Mm-hmm. I work with the folks who book the touring shows. And by that I mean our folks who are our like AAA team, the folks that are rising through the ranks, to potentially be on our stages. We have three touring companies, Red, Blue, and Green. And in the winter, we can have up to five, actually, because Christmas shows. So I work with those folks. We have a contract with Norwegian Cruise Lines. So we have three people on three ships at any given time doing shows for Second City. We have a third space now, Up Comedy Club, which I preside over the programming and things in there. And then in the last couple of years, we've been really trying to launch a theatricals division. And so we have, this year we have three shows on tour. We have our, coming out actually soon, we'll have our, Slate Unelectable You. So we're doing a show in partnership with Slate Magazine.
Yeah.
Called Unelectable You, and that will tour, in the political, you know, September, October.
It's like a sketch comedy show?
It will be sketch. It will be some real, it will maybe have some music. It will have some, real interrogation, because we're going to have slate personalities in as many of the shows as we can, either live or live fed potentially. We're really wrapping the show so that people who are slatesters, as they call themselves, will get some of the inside jokes that are happening, whereas it will be a real political show for anyone. So I don't want to say it's a variety show, but I think it could lend its form. It's going to be a much bigger show than people are used to from us. We're having projections and sort of a CNN newsroom feel with the set design.
Wow.
And then in the winter, we're going to tour our Second City spin on A Christmas Carol, which has, you know, Twister Dickens, which we've done at the Goodman.
At the Goodman, yeah.
We've done at Center Theater Group. We've done at Portland Stage. So that's being done. And then we also have a bunch of partnerships with some regional theaters. This year, we're going to the Kennedy Center in the lab space in the summer to do Unauthorized Guide to America. We're going to go back to Woolly Mammoth in the winter to do a show with them. We're talking to a couple of other regionals. We're co-commissioning a playwright with La Jolla Playhouse.
Have you ever commissioned a playwright
before?
We've
commissioned some internal writers from our system, like the Twister Dickens was a commission, and Death of a Streetcar Named Virginia Woolf, which will premiere May 5th, actually, will open at Writers Theater.
Oh, cool.
Here was a Second City commission originally. So we've been doing that, but the La Jolla is an interesting thing in that it's a playwright that I actually knew from Steppenwolf.
Okay.
And
we
introduced these folks here to that playwright, and La Jolla has worked with him. So it became sort of this joint, we're both interested in this playwright.
Oh. Have you announced to the playwright yet?
No, we haven't yet.
Okay.
But it's somebody I think people will be really excited to be like, oh my gosh, that's fantastic that you guys are moving in this direction of commissioning and creating original musicals. We've had conversations with Thomas Bradshaw this year about a project. So we're really trying to do different types of work.
And when you commission a playwright, do you ask them, like, is it a play? Is it a sketch show? Is it something that you would think of with Second City, or is it be kind of what they want?
With Matt Hubdy, who's creating the Slate show, we have writers working on that. So we have Matt himself writing some stuff with Steve Waltine, who's a Second City alum, who's also really into Slate.
Okay.
And they're writing some of the sketches. With Death of a Streetcar, it's a much more traditional play, though it's, I think, and we have really traditional Chicago actors in that, folks like Mark Grapey and Jennifer Engstrom from Red Orchid. So folks that have worked at a lot of theaters that, but they're thinking in terms of Second City process in their rehearsals. And I think that's the thing that playwrights are interested in when we speak to them about a commission. It's not necessarily that they want to write a play together. It's that they want to embrace that Second City methodology of let's be in a room, let's see some things on their feet, let's see what's working in this scene. Oh, actually, what you said by mistake is actually better than I wrote. Or what you are saying, even if it's not by mistake, might be better. Let's talk about that.
So it's sort of like devising a little bit.
It is. I mean, what we've been doing, it's what's so funny is what we've been doing in this building for 50-some-odd years is devised work in a way. I think some playwrights are really excited we form our shows downstairs. Our sketch shows, really, they write. People bring in material. And I think some playwrights really want to write, you know, by themselves. But they still want to be in the room with the, you know, creating. So we really are just in conversations with artists, whether it's directors who are pitching something or writers or team. Like we had a music director and composer and a book writer pitch us something last week. We're interested in seeing what that is. We're not interested in, you know, a sketch show out of that. We're interested in a musical satirical musical play.
Yeah.
And finding a pathway for that. So it's different stuff. It's not necessarily sketch anymore, just.
Yeah. It sounds like there's going to be a lot more crossover now between your old Steppenwolf world and your new Second City world with this.
Well, I think, especially with the touring division, you know, the theatrical touring division, we need stage managers and designers that we know from that world. Mm-hmm. So I brought over Brian Lovner, who's the former managing director from Chicago Dramatists and also has done commercial producing, to really be our managing producer on this, because both of us know that those designers and those stage managers and those tech directors, and those are the people that we really need for this new world. You know, we know how to nurture and mentor people in this building for all the work on these stages. But even the show that's running right now in our Up Theater Club, it's a hashtag date me an OkCupid experience. It's a much more traditional theatrical experience. And so we have the stage manager that stage managed for us for Twister Diggins at Goodman is who we brought over for that run this year because it's somebody that really knows how to manage theatrical stage management as opposed to just knowing really that, you know, I don't know if she knows how to do a good blackout for a sketch, but she's much more able to maintain a theatrical show.
Yeah.
So it's just these different skills and hopefully over time those skills will cross so that at some point if she's interested, she's, you know, stage managing something in the building elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know, people just enter this, I think, field in different places.
Yeah. Is a good blackout the key to sketch?
Is a good blackout the key to sketch?
I think of all the blackouts in sketch comedy.
But there, I mean,
it's like comedic timing of designers,
the stage manager has to know how to do that, right? Like we talk about how the guy who's on our main stage is sort of an ingenious guy at knowing when to do the blackout during like sets, you know, because a lot of the stuff, even that you see in our shows, once they're set.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we do our improv sets, as we call them, our sets after the show. Those are the late night stuff that's open to anyone that wants to come in.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, he's really controlling that light board. So it's that instinct. It's not unlike a music director, right? It's the same. The music director and the stage manager really have to be in sync with those actors.
Yeah.
And so it is a skill that, like, I would never have thought about.
I never thought about till you said
it. Down the road.
Do a good blackout.
Right. But it's like, oh, somebody, you should be, like, trained to inherently learn how to do that.
Yeah.
Or maybe you can be a natural at it, but I certainly wouldn't want to say I would know.
No,
like, okay, that's the joke.
Yeah. Wow. I'm going to watch the show tonight. I'm going to see the show tonight.
Right.
So differently.
Right.
And I want to go back to your role at Steppenwolf and talk a little bit specifically about your role in casting, because it's such an interesting position at a company like Steppenwolf, which is ensemble-based and is, you know, has an ensemble company of a lot of actors. Is your role as a casting director different in a company like that, where there is kind of this stable of talent there?
Well, I think, you know, at Steppenwolf, I would always say everything, at least during my tenure, and I can imagine it's only increased because Anna is very pro-ensemble, everything was ensemble first, you know, so you would, a lot of the programming was picked with the ensemble in mind and to be in communication with them. So you would have ensemble members bringing plays to you and you would be giving plays to ensemble members and then figuring out, okay, is there a role in here for one or two of them? You know, where do they fit in? Having those conversations with the directors and then sort of going from there, it wasn't like that you had seven people that could play all the 20-year-olds or something like that. So certain roles, you definitely did a big reach in the community for casting. So it started with the ensemble and then it would go to, the Chicago community and really trying to get people to embrace as many Chicagoans, as possible because Steppenwolf really thought of itself and thinks of itself as a Chicago company. And then, you know, depending on the director, you might, or the role, because there are certain things in this community that I think we're still growing in terms of our actor base. So for many, you know, when I cast Homebody Kabul, there wasn't a huge, plethora of Middle Eastern actors here in Chicago that I could go to for that role. So I found myself in LA and New York doing a lot more of the casting. For the more commie pieces Frank did, I found myself in New York and in California for Asian American actors, you know, so it was a different, it was based on that need. I think for everything else, we really tried to find, you know, in the Chicago wheelhouse, but you did work with directors who they knew New York actors. They direct in New York. They don't even want to do a session in New York. They just want the specific actor because of the relationship. And so you honor that too.
Yeah.
And you try really hard to present as many options. I always joke that, you know, I put the buffet out. And in the end, I think my big thing was to try to reflect back to a director what I had heard them say they needed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to have enough information about what the director wanted with a character so that I could reflect back to them the things I would see or know about an actor. And I think over time, what I became good at was knowing, like, if an actor walking in might screw up the audition in the first minute, but after a minute they calm down and pay attention to them. You know, I was good at being like, don't pay attention to the first 2 minutes of this actor's auditions. They'll sink in after 2 minutes and then you'll have them. Or knowing if somebody was having an off day and saying, we really should bring that person back for a callback. That was atypical. Mm-hmm. Let me talk to them and let's have them come back tomorrow. But also being able to say to a director, look, you have two choices. And what I'm hearing you say you need is this. Neither of them are doing that exactly, but I feel with person A, you're going to get it more quickly and it's a small role. So do you really have time? You know, so I would try to speak back to the director, and some of it is also just budgetarily things on the smaller spaces at Steppenwolf. You have less equity contracts. Mm-hmm. So you're trying to say you can have this permutation or this permutation, but you can't have this permutation. Yeah. And so you try to, and then you try to have the conversation of, based on your needs, if I was you, I would try to do this. Yeah. Or you should know that this actor sometimes can be difficult to work with, but they're brilliant. Yeah. Just want to say that to you. You know, so it's a lot of speaking back and getting to know deep. And then you learn people's tastes over time, mm-hmm. right? You just know what kinds of actors people will be interested in. And yeah. So you know, oh, Tina Landau wants somebody who can act and move well, potentially sing songs, and they might want to play, she might want them to play a musical instrument during mm-hmm. the show. So it's, I always said, Tina wants actors plus.
Yeah.
Whereas like Anna and Amy, depending on the shows they were working, I was working with them on, it was sit in a chair, be in the moment, let me see the simplicity of you being acting in the moment. And it was just a very different audition feel.
Yeah. Well, is it interesting bringing in actors as cast director to an ensemble company? Do you have to brief the actor? Like, is it a different experience for them, or is it the same experience they would have on another show?
No, I'd say, and that's one of the reasons I really like being here. I like being in places that promote that ensemble feel. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there was never any need to prep anyone at Steppenwolf because the ensemble members rose. Mm-hmm. They rose to that position of, embracing mm-hmm. and, being, leaders in those rooms, you know, like making it clear that we walk in the door as one and you walk in the door as one with us. Mm-hmm. You know, if John Malkovich walks through that building, he behaves no differently than Marianne Mayberry. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the same. And I think that's true of many theaters in Chicago, that ensemble vibe. And I think in Second City, what I didn't know is it's very similar because there are people that are on the stage a few times. You know, they do three shows and they're, you know, the vets. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the new people that are coming in for their first show. And again, it's the behavior of the vets embracing and leading those new people and creating, and the director and them creating an ensemble together. And I think I find it rare outside of Chicago, but I think it happens in Chicago most often.
Yeah, and there are a lot of parallels between the Second City ensemble mindset. It's not specifically an acting ensemble, right. But there's touring companies, there's people, it's like, people who have gone on to SNL and things like that have like such right. a strong association with the brand. They're not in the ensemble, obviously, but there's not yeah. an ensemble. But there are parallels between
yeah.
the two.
And you don't think about it until you're like really thinking about it. Cause I really never gave thought to it, but it's also the notion of I am better because I am on stage with you mm-hmm. because I know you so well and you know me so well.
Yeah.
This has become a shorthand. And I think that's August Osage County. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the magic of that. Mm-hmm. People say, you know, and that casting sort of came about 2 weeks. I mean, we lost two actors, mm-hmm. you know, right before we started rehearsal, about 2 weeks before we started rehearsal. But it was knowing how to recast, how to, you know, that made that cast as special as it was. And you have that many ensemble members on stage together and that many people who knew each other in mm-hmm. other areas, and it just became like, oh, the shorthand in a room, in a rehearsal room, then becomes really important in an epic piece like that.
Yeah. One of my favorite Steppenwolf casting stories, and you've never told it to me, so I'd love to hear it from your perspective.
But it's your story.
No, it's not my story. It's the casting Virginia Woolf.
Carrie Coon. That was like her first big thing. It was, you know, Tracy Letts and Amy Morton, and then you had to cast Madison and Carrie.
Yes, you had to cast Honey and Nick. Oh my gosh. Yes.
And I mean, you cast Carrie, who had a big Chicago profile at the time. I mean, she'd done some shows with the Goodman, but she was still fairly...
She was barely new. She really hadn't done that much. I mean, she'd done, like, I think a show at the Goodman, really.
I think she did
Magnolia, and that was really it. And was really still coming out of her Madison, Wisconsin sort of life.
Yeah.
She worked at APT and things like that, and I knew her from up there. And to be honest, you know, it's... That's a hard play to cast because everybody wants to, I mean, well, it's a hard play to cast because, you know, Amy and Tracy are going to get a play together. Everybody wants that audition.
Mm-hmm.
Every young person in the city of Chicago and, you know, they're like, I'm right for that.
Mm-hmm.
And Amy and Tracy are also two tall human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So Pam McKinnon, the director, and I had had conversations and we were like, okay, nobody under like the height of 5'10 can play Nick because Tracy would not be intimidated by somebody much smaller, and Amy would look ridiculous, like, seducing somebody, like, 5'6". I mean, it would just look strange, like, the whole, you know, so we knew that that was, I'm sorry, an understanding that we were having, and Honey is described by Albie as being, you know, thin-hipped and mousy, like, she's got a description, too, that is reiterated throughout the play, and we did open. Albie allowed us the very 11th hour. He was like, well, why don't you audition African-American and Asian women also? I can't remember if he said Latina as well. I honestly can't. But we even opened it, which was unusual because it's 1950s. And, you know, it was an unusual directive, but we followed it.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was very challenging because we auditioned a ton of people, called a bunch of people back. It's, you know, you're asking people in an audition moment to do we asked them to do a very difficult scene where, you know, she has a breakdown and runs out of the room after it's revealed that, you know, the big emotional moment and the reveal. And it's,
like the one person who hasn't read Who's Afraid of Virginia
Woolf. Yeah. I'm like, kind of.
It's not spoiler. Like, no spoilers.
There's a big reveal and Honey flies out of the room screaming and clutching and goes to the bathroom.
Okay.
And curls up on a floor like a mouse. But we asked them to do a much, you know, but we also needed, you know, she's drunk for much of the play. So it was also people were playing drunk. I mean, it's a very hard audition. And at the callback, we had Tracy reading opposite the Honeys. We asked him to come in. Not to exaggerate, after the first audition, I think we knew Carrie had knocked it out of the park, but it was one of those things where you're like, we barely knew her and we barely really had seen her work other than in Magnolia. We were like, okay, well, she's certainly on her way, but wow. And then her callback with Tracy, it was just sensational. He was like, wow, well, she knocked that out of the park. I mean, it was like we called like five women back and it was just, it was very clear. It was just a very clear thing. And it was like, this is where we're going with this. This is crazy. And then of course it was absolutely the right choice. And you know, that's the moment that I don't want to own Carrie Coon's career, but that's the moment that begins to make somebody's career
that,
what it
I mean,
is.
That was my next question. What is that experience like for you when you really did cast her in her first thing and now she has this amazing career? It's like, there's so many opportunities like that at Steppenwolf and at Second City where like this really becomes a national platform for talent.
You know what, it's, I am sure I'm speaking like any casting director out there. It's the greatest moment. It's the greatest moment when you cast somebody for the first time in a place you know they've dreamed of working their whole life.
Mm-hmm.
That never gets old. And it's a dream moment when you cast somebody in a role you know they're dying to play. Because they're, you know, everybody has their dream roles. And I think for that, for people in that moment, that play was really a dream because Pam McKinnon and Edward Albee, and, I mean, you knew Albee was going to come in because he and Pam are very close. Tracy and Amy. I mean, it's, and Steppenwolf. Mm-hmm. So that's, for most people, that's like the, you know, the trifecta.
It's more than three.
Yeah, it's more than three. It's a quadruple. But you know, it's huge. So you know you're, no matter what happens in somebody's career, you know you're changing a life in that moment. I think when you know somebody is as talented as Carrie Coon, mm-hmm. but also as gracious and humble as Carrie Coon, mm-hmm. it becomes really lovely because you know, and I love the fact, let's be honest, the thing I love most is that she's now married to Tracy Letts, and that's actually what makes me the most happy.
Yeah.
And I've done that a few times, like, Pam McKinnon's boyfriend, John Procaccino.
Yeah.
That's me. I mean, she inherited a play from Amy Morton because in the moment that August was going to New York, Amy could no longer direct Roberta Sagasta's Good Boys and True. And we asked Pam McKinnon to direct it, and John Procaccino was already cast. So that's how they met.
So you did that.
And there have been a couple of others. Like, it's very funny where people have said, oh my God, I guess I should thank you. Ariane Moayed and mm-hmm. his life partner. Oh, he's married now. Chrissy Shields and he got married. Homebody Kabul. So it's these funny things. And I gotta be honest, that makes me the most happy when I realize that somebody's true happiness had somehow weirdly had something to do with a casting moment. Cause that's so random.
That is so random.
But with Carrie, I think she's so talented. She's so humble. And gracious, and you never know if it's going to hit for somebody. You know, it's such a random, subjective chance business.
Yeah.
So to give somebody an opportunity to have a profile in New York of that nature, I think it's terrific when you know, God, this might not have happened for somebody otherwise. What a shame for all of us if Carrie Coon was just randomly still in. And it's wonderful for APT or Milwaukee or Madison. Theater. But you go, gosh, it would be a shame if we weren't all benefiting from seeing some of her work.
Yeah. And I mean, Carrie's just a story that I know. I'm sure there's other people that you've had seen cast from Chicago.
At different theaters that just go on to have these incredible careers and stories and, mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you don't have as much of a hand in casting now, do you?
You know what? Beth Kligerman is our casting director here, director of casting and talent development. And she is very much, I mean, it's a lot of conversations are happening among a few people, myself included, about like the touring stuff. The resident stages, a lot of those conversations are led by Allison Riley, who produces those shows, and Tyler Alexander, as well as the director of that show, so they sort of lead that conversation. The theatricals projects, Beth and I are definitely working on more together because some of those people are more musical theater people or outside of this building. So we really are in conversation about that stuff together, which has been really fun actually for both of us. It's allowed me to really learn fast about everyone in this building. And I think it's been fun for her to, you know, be in shorthand with me about some of the other folks that are from the world I used to have who really could cross over into this world.
Yeah.
So it's been a fun year, I think, for us together.
Definitely. What are some things that maybe are new for you in this job and that you're kind of learning and
moving
forward?
I mean, I've never managed more than, you know, two people at once.
Really?
So to manage a team of 8 and 9 people is huge. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm used to being accountable, definitely, but not being accountable to numbers in a way I am here because we're looking at budgets on a show by show basis. Mm-hmm. And the buck stops with me in a way as trying to launch this division. Theatricals division in particular. A lot of other things are sort of, you know, self-sustaining, but also programming, like really on my own, trying to have lead conversations about like programming in our upspace or which projects and pitches. I really try to have these conversations with the team before making the decisions. But in the end, somebody has to make a decision. Mm-hmm. That wasn't me before. It's a lot of learning about who's in this building. I mean, it's a whole, I don't think I knew 95% of the people in this building. Having lived in Chicago nearly 20 some odd years, I didn't know any of the people in this building. So that's been a lot of learning. And I'm doing things like I didn't really work as much in marketing or, any of, or any of that stuff. And we're working really closely with like Allied mm-hmm. on our tours and yeah. we have a marketing team here for our other shows. So it's a lot of new skills that I had to learn really fast.
Yeah.
That had nothing to do with like art. You know?
No, that's great. And I mean,
so that's really challenging.
Management skills are so yeah. crucial to the arts, and it's the level of the arts that's not talked about a lot, I don't feel.
Right.
Like, or at
right.
least in the press, right. as people talk to right. the writers and the actors, and so.
Right. And I always knew how to do that, but this is, it's different. And also the big difference is, of course, you know, we don't have a board of directors.
Oh, interesting.
It's a for-profit organization. Mm-hmm. So I'm used to having a board of directors that are, not asking for, you know, any input in the artistic vision at all, but you know, they're engaged in it. And here there isn't that. And you're also trying to figure out how to, you know, get your plays done without, development support. There's no development department.
Yeah.
You know, so that's
right,
because
you're a for-profit.
That's a huge difference. Like I'm used to spending hours a day yeah. talking to people in the development department about grants that we're applying for, or, oh my gosh, this person wants to organize a dinner or a toast or this or that. And I joked with Adam Belcourt, who's the casting director of The Good Men and Bob Mason, who's at Chicago Shakespeare, that the big difference is that I don't have any development meetings. And they made a joke like, oh my God, you must have hours every day. And I was like, yeah, to like do all these other things that need to be done. But it's, you know, that's a radical shift. A lot of my last job was in development and working with the fundraisers.
Yeah. So, but you do develop new works here. I mean, all totally. Second City does. And
our
so.
Ownership has been really wonderful, and they give us a line item in development. They give us a development budget every year. It's not nearly
enough. So you get
enough.
Development money that you don't have to apply for grants for?
Well, it's not. I'm being honest. It is I joke because it is, if I would much prefer to be able to apply for grants because the grants would help us tremendously compared to what the budget is.
Fair enough.
It is like my first day on the job. I was like, really? That's it? Cause I knew how little that would get us if we want to grow.
Yeah.
And so that's just excellent learning also, like how to do things in phases and yeah. how to be in good faith with people and do things incrementally so that everybody feels like they're being valued. Mm-hmm. The artists feel like they're being valued. You're able to engage in conversations with people who are in conversations with Steppenwolf and the Goodman, you know, yeah. that's a, you know, it's, people want to, you can't lowball people in this field, and you're having conversations with the same agents.
Mm-hmm.
And so trying to do things in a tiered level so that you go, if we take it to this step, we'll do this. And if we take it to this step, so that people feel like they're not being taken advantage of, which I think is that's really important for me for artists in any bucket to feel valued.
Yeah. That's great. But I mean, you do partner with nonprofits as well. It's just
yes. Opinion. And we're doing that too. Absolutely. That's how we're able, that's
that
how,
helps
that's
with
how we're able to do a lot of our, you know, the projects that are one-offs, but you know, in order to sustain something long-term, to have a long life, takes time. And it really, the Book of Mormon is a 10-year endeavor. And so how much money that took, I can't imagine. But, you know, to be able to develop the SpongeBobs and the back, they really take a lot of time.
Yeah. You're not working on either of those projects.
No. I'm just saying, like,
those,
for example,
those
you want to have, right.
Yeah.
You want to have the ability to find something that is exciting and know you have the time to develop it mm-hmm. and then the resources to back
yeah.
that up.
I mean, Hamilton took like 10 years to write.
Right. Right.
Paid off, I think.
I think Book of Mormon. I think it's
Book of Mormon paid off too.
Well.
Yeah.
I think it's going to do very well. And great. I am excited about SpongeBob.
I am too. I have some friends that are in it.
I am actually excited. I believe Tina Landa will really do something interesting.
I think
that.
It'll be cool. Yeah. There's some good people in the
absolutely.
Cast.
It's absolutely.
It's coming to Chicago first.
It yeah. is. I know. It's like goes into rehearsals really soon, and I will be there.
You're so excited about SpongeBob. I love it.
I know. I haven't seen a play in a really long time, but I'm excited about SpongeBob.
Oh, my gosh.
And we're back. With some recommendations, let's talk about things we've seen or read or want to talk about. Susie?
I was just about to check my phone, then I realized I haven't recommended a show I saw on Broadway. I know it was on Broadway, but I loved it. I loved Waitress. I had a really good time. It started at American Repertory Theater, so shout out to the nonprofits, and just got some Tony nominations. It's really incredible. I had a really good time. It's one of my favorite new musicals this season, and Jesse Mueller is giving an amazing performance. You just don't think she can get better, and then she does, and just breaks your heart. And, you know, I always tell people that I went to UCLA, and so did Sarah Bareilles. We actually didn't overlap, but I feel like there's like a kindred spirit there. Mm-hmm. I also once saw her in Sleep No More, so that was pretty cool. And she's written a really good score for theater, and it's some of them feel like pop songs, like an album. I think she's recorded a concept album herself of most of the songs, but
wait,
it's
she
on
was
Spotify.
She was in Sleep No More, Sarah Bareilles?
No, One Night Only. Sarah Bareilles was in Sleep No More. She gave a concert, and
oh, she
was in it.
Okay.
And I found her in her like thing, and she picked me out of the crowd for a one-on-one, and she told me ghost stories and spoon-fed me tea and like whispered in my ear, and I couldn't say anything, and I was like in this hut in the woods and Sleep No More with Sarah Bareilles.
Wow.
So it's a theatrical highlight of my life.
Pixar didn't happen. Just kidding. Go
on. No, there's no pics. I couldn't even talk to her. She takes your mask off and Sleep No More, and I was like, I'm sitting with Sarah Bareilles. She's playing a maid in the woods. This is crazy.
Nice.
No, the score's great. And I mean, Christopher Fitzgerald is hilarious. He got a Tony nomination today. Kimiko Glenn is great. She's from Orange is the New Black. Kala Settle is great. Everyone's great. It's just, it's a...
Her Jesse Miller really sucks, though. No,
Jesse Miller is amazing. And the show's good. The show's, it's a little different for Diane Paulus. Diane Paulus directed it, the artistic director of Verity.
So it's not brassy and sassy and...
Not really.
It's sort of quiet.
Well, I mean, the original film, the original Adrian Shelley film isn't a sassy film. It's like
no,
a very
it's
quiet,
yeah.
little indie.
A lot of the dialogue is borrowed from the film, and it stays very true to the film.
I love that movie so much, though.
You should
I
see it. It's great.
Movie.
Or you should just download Tara Bareilles' concept album on Spotify.
So can you smell the pies in the house?
You can. And they also use like real ingredients on stage.
Wow.
Yeah.
Great. This is a dramaturgy of smells. We should talk
it's
about
really
that.
Good. I like it a lot.
What did Mark Blankenship's... What phrase did he point?
Aromaturgy.
Sorry, that's
well,
right.
Well, they're cooking pies in the back, not as part of the show, so...
Okay.
Although maybe they are, just because it does take place in a pie diner. For those who don't know, a waitress is about a waitress who cooks pie who's kind of down on her luck in a pie diner.
And wants to escape an unhappy marriage.
And wants to escape an abusive, unhappy marriage.
It's a real slice of life, what you're telling me.
It's really great. Jesse Mueller is something else, guys.
Yeah. That movie inspired me to want to make pies from scratch. And I know how, which is a good talent to have, I guess. I
wonder if they're making like a Tony nominations pie tonight. All the pies have silly names.
Deep, what you got?
So if you don't know how I got into theater, it was because of Sarah Kane. Well, partially because of Sarah Kane. And so recently I saw this play at Soho Rep that I've described to people as Sarah Kane, but funny. Her plays usually aren't very funny. And it's called Revolt, She Said Revolt Again by British playwright Alice Birch, directed by Liliana Blaine Cruz. And it's currently running at Soho Rep. It just got extended. It's now running to May 22nd. And it's a 65-minute play, very short, and it's basically a series of vignettes about different aspects of modern femininity and also how to dismantle it in the face of the oppressive patriarchy. And so the first section is about language and about how language is used to uphold male dominance. And so it's kind of like, you know, say things like a man makes love to a woman or a woman receives sex. It's dismantling like the different gendered structures within our society. And then at the end, there's an explosion and people get their tongues cut off.
Spoilers. You show me the script. It doesn't sound like the parts are assigned, right? It's just,
nope.
It looks like it's just words, right? It's just,
yeah. Well, if you ever read Sarah Kane's, Four Psychosis. 448 Psychosis. It's the same thing. Okay. Of it's basically one long.
But that's usually done as a solo piece, right?
Yeah, and
I saw it as a two-hander.
Yeah.
Okay, it was done as an ensemble piece once too. So I guess it can be done. However.
There's some freedom on how you do it. But Alice Birch made it a little bit easier in that sometimes like she'll have a break.
Okay.
A different like a blank line. That's how you know it's a different character. Or like she'll have lines in the middle of the page.
Right.
So it's a very interesting read, but it definitely wouldn't register the same way on the page as as on stage.
So there's a lot. The director, Blaine Cruz, is really an up-and-comer director. Had a lot to do.
Oh, definitely.
With what you're seeing on stage. She also directed Red Speedo.
Yeah, there's no like set direction. There's right. no, it's just a bunch of different scenes and there's no way for you to know how to present the scene.
Do you see the piece in Slate about it?
I've skimmed
Slate
it really.
Covered
the soul, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Slate, like their language person, the person who writes about
right,
language,
right.
because that play is very much about gendered language and also the role of femininity in modern society.
Well, Slate's getting all up in our, it's because of Dan Coyes. They're getting all up in our theater stuff and even stealing Isaac Butler occasionally. But anyway, that's a whole other story. So it's revolt, period.
I mean,
she said, period, revolt.
Revolt again.
Revolt again.
Yeah.
Yes.
All
right.
So,
I'm going to really briefly, because it's been a long podcast, I was looking forward with that mix of sort of anticipation and dread about something you really are looking forward to shuffle along. I'd heard the buzz was that it was really long and a mess. And when I met with George Wolfe, you can look at my interview with him online. He was a little on edge. We had a sort of a contentious, but I think productive interview about the show. And I'm happy to report, as most of the critics have said, that it's a real joy. And it's a real, it's not just a joy. It's a real sort of, I don't know, a blessing. It feels like a very special show. There's shows that come along. Actually, the last one he directed on Broadway, I think, was Lucky Guy. Mm-hmm. Is that what it's called?
That is correct. Nora Ephron's last play.
Not a great play, but it also felt, no,
blasphemy.
It was, okay, it was kind of a terrible play, but I was reminded because that play had a sense, maybe George Wolfe had something, had a sense of only New York. It felt like a real New York play. And this one feels like a real Broadway play. It felt like the first half, the dancing is so delightful and so just a joy. And the singing, the musical theater aspect of it, it made me think like, oh, this is like Crazy for You or,
I kept thinking of 42nd Street.
Nice work. Yeah, right. Exactly. Like these old style Broadway musicals. But it's like, why shouldn't there be a black one? And why shouldn't we go back to the, what historically was the very first jazz one that changed the sound of Broadway, which is Shuffle Along in 1921. And then was kind of like picked over for the best parts and discarded and forgotten. You know, what George Wolfe doesn't quite make a case that Shuffle Along was a great show that's worth reviving as a show because there's almost none of the script in it. And I've heard from people who've read the script and have done readings of it that you could not produce that script on Broadway now. There's too many stereotypes and it just doesn't hold up. It's like one of those old shows from the 20s that has a flimsy book and great songs. So he does something different and he honors the people in the show. And, you know, it's a little preachy. There's a little bit of self-congratulation in it. It's like, as a friend of mine said, I've never seen a show that asks you to like it so much. But I really think that also translates into a sort of eagerness to please, which is gold in a musical when you can please this well. So
I mean, the dancing is insane.
The dancing is great. The ensemble is the real star. And, I don't know how well it would translate to the rest of the country, but I felt like this is, I mean, the most amazing kind of numbers in the second act when there's a lot of great numbers, but just in terms of blowing your mind is the one in which, I forget his name, Carl something, this sort of white patron talks about,
Oh yeah, the one he's talking.
He's saying, no one's going to remember you to people on stage who are being remembered in the show. It's this sort of.
They won't remember you. Isn't
right.
it like,
they won't remember you. They won't remember
the
you. Which by the way, who wrote that song? That's not from the original at all. So there's a bunch of like new material in this, not just in the book, but in the score. Anyway, it's a fascinating play, which, I'm glad it exists. It's sort of like almost a religious ritual for Broadway, remembering the ancestors. And I hope it runs for a long time. I think that's the end of our podcast. Deep, what do we say at the end usually?
If you need links to the things that we talked about today, check our website. And also review us and rate us on iTunes so that it'll be easier for people to find us.
Sounds good. Till next time.
Goodbye.